You want Black Friday prices without the Black Friday crowds. Lowe's gets it. We checked the calendar, and Christmas is coming early. $99 is all you need to grab your favorite select 7-foot pre-lit artificial Christmas tree for the holiday season. And don't sweat what gifts to get Dad, because we've got up to 40% off select tools and accessories. That's how Lowe's celebrates Black Friday early. Selection varies by location while supplies last.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. His greatest speech is Diana Schaub's new book, How Lincoln Moved the Nation. 1838, the young man. Now it is 1863, the battlefield of Gettysburg. The dead in shallow graves all around the president as he speaks for a few minutes on a day of great concern to all who are in attendance, because this is a war president who is facing the re-election unlikely the following year. The war is going very badly in the number of dead already, November of 1863. We know the Gettysburg Address is famous. It wasn't. It wasn't for many decades. It, however, is a wonderful match to the second inaugural in 1865. And we begin first with the Professor Diana Schaub's analysis that this is a war speech. Three paragraphs, 10 sentences, 271 words. War speech how, Professor?
Because his task really is to rally the nation to defeat the insurgents. You just mentioned that the war was going badly. There was a terrible problem of morale, how to maintain northern morale. And it seems to me that is what he is addressing in this speech. And it's a very difficult assignment because he has to give a war speech without demonizing those rebellious fellow citizens. In other words, a speech delivered against foreign enemies is much easier to craft. This is a Civil War speech, and that rhetorical dilemma is much more difficult.
47 years ago takes us to 1776. The foundation here is the Declaration of Independence. How does he use it? Because the whole idea of insurrection is dangerous at this moment.
Yeah, he believes that the war itself, the rebellion itself, is an attempt to invalidate the truths on which the nation was founded, or to deny those truths. So what he does in that very short first opening paragraph, which is just one sentence, is to remind us of what the nation is, to give us a definition of the nation. The nation is conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. So those two things, liberty and equality. He then goes on to explain what then is at stake in the war, what is being tested. What is being tested is whether that nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to human equality, whether that nation can survive, and whether any nation so conceived and so dedicated can survive.
The secession was the villain, the enemy here. And the president wants to always make it clear to his audience that the secessionists were not equal to the revolutionaries, the American revolutionaries. Was he successful, or was there some doubt after hearing his remarks?
You see him doing this also in the first inaugural, where he lays out exactly why secession differs from a legitimate exercise of the right of revolution. Lincoln never denies that there is a right of revolution. But what he points out is that the secessionists didn't actually claim to be exercising a right of revolution. They claimed there was some sort of constitutional right of secession. And Lincoln, I think, very decisively shows that that is not the case. So this is, in fact, an argument that he has been laying out since the first inaugural.
He is educated in the trivium. What is that, Professor?
That is one half of the classical studies. The trivium is the three parts, the study of grammar, the study of logic, and the study of rhetoric. And Lincoln had taught himself those elements. He was a very accomplished grammarian. Grammar is, you know, sort of the blood and sinew of language. Then you need to, you know, use that grammar to pursue logic, to formulate logic. Then there is that final step. You have to present arguments that will be persuasive to others. And that involves more than simply logic. So that rhetoric involves these other forms of appeal as well. And you can really study Lincoln's speeches to see a master rhetorician at work.
In this speech, 271 words, the professor makes some revelations to me for the first time. One, there are only two words that are proper nouns, God and liberty. Liberty how? What does we can presume this is the Protestant God of Christian America. But liberty, what does that mean to Lincoln and his audience at the time?
Yeah, boy, that is a very large question. I'm not sure I can answer that in the course of a couple of minutes. I think it's an unusual formulation. He says that the nation was conceived in liberty. That could mean various things. Does it mean that the nation was conceived out of the love of liberty, a longing for liberty? Does it mean the nation was conceived in a sort of decisive act of liberty? You know, that Declaration of Independence and the fight for it. There's also a way in which liberty very much has to be understood in relationship to equality. Sometimes, in fact, Lincoln will describe the equality principle as really meaning the promise of liberty for all.
The humility in the speech you emphasize, and that if I understand you correctly, this is commonplace for orators at the time. It no longer is commonplace in the 20th or the 21st century. I have no personal experience of a politician being humble. What did it mean for Lincoln to keep himself out? There's not an I in this speech. Is that correct?
That's right. And there is only one self-reference, really, in the second inaugural. So this is a very characteristic element of his rhetoric, the suppression of self. It's especially true of his presidential rhetoric. And what replaces the I in the Gettysburg Address is we. The constant invocation of we, you know, we are gathered here, you know, it's altogether fitting and proper that we do this. So that's, you know, linked with his attempt to bind the Union together. The humility in the second inaugural is maybe even more thoroughgoing, has a kind of Christian character to it.
The other part of the speech in Gettysburg is to know what he said immediately after learning of the victory at Gettysburg and Vicksburg. The twin victories spelled the halfway point and the downslope for the war, but it would take more years and more deaths. In making impromptu remarks in Washington outside the White House, a gathering of people to celebrate him and sing him songs, and he responded. He mentioned Jefferson and Adams, and then he said, I am not prepared. So between July 7th and November, when he gave the Gettysburg Address, he takes out all of the a connection to the founders. It just disappears. What did he mean by that? Is he looking to the future? Is he looking to win the war now? You know, you remember they called FDR Dr. Win the War. Is this Dr. Win the War at Gettysburg?
I want to quarrel with you just a little bit. It's true that that the difference between the July 7 sort of response to a serenade, it's called, the difference between that speech and Gettysburg is that he drops a lot of the particulars. He no longer mentions, Jefferson and Adams dying on the same day on the golden anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. But he is still tying the nation to the founding through the reference to 1776, 47 years ago. But he has, in a way, rendered it more abstract. And Gettysburg is a very abstract speech. I mean, he also takes out any reference to the name Gettysburg. He takes out all of those things that would localize it more. And I think this is actually part of the reason why the speech is able to appeal to later generations and even to people in other countries. He has, in a way, formulated the task, the generational task of defending self-government in a way that has a universal appeal.
I'm speaking to Professor Diana Schaub. We're taking apart three speeches. I'm just touching on the things that I've learned from the professor. There's much more here. But for heaven's sakes, we're talking about a man who constructed these things in the midst of a national crisis. There was an emergency at every moment, and the president couldn't know what was actually happening in his country. Communication wasn't that good. So his audience, everyone who heard this, those who were grieving, those who were expecting to hear from the worst. Remember, when soldiers went off or when people went looking for soldiers, you didn't know where they were for days, weeks, or months. People could disappear into time. So Abraham Lincoln's giving a speech now that we're reading backwards from the 21st century. We're now going to go to the great second inaugural, which the professor introduces as a match for the Gettysburg Address, the war address, followed by the peace address, in March of 1865. The book is Diana Schaub's His Greatest Speeches, How Lincoln Moved the Nation, 1838, 1863, and now 1865. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section. When dad injured his back, when your basketball star tore his ACL, opioids helped with the pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Opioids are powerful pain-reducing prescription medicines, but most people who are prescribed opioids don't finish their prescriptions. So millions of unused opioids are sitting in homes across the country, and tragically, more than 100 Americans die every day from overdoses involving opioids. What can you do to protect your family? Remove the risk of unused opioids from your home. Pills, patches, or syrups in drawers, purses, and cabinets. Anywhere they might be hiding. To find out how to dispose of them properly, visit www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Every school bus and classroom. I go to school with your children.
We say the Pledge of Allegiance together.
You see me around the neighborhood and you tell me that I'm a pretty good kid.
Well, I'm one out of every five children in America and I'm struggling with hunger.
This problem is closer than you think. My teacher tells me we can grow up to be whatever we want.
I want to grow up to be someone who doesn't go to bed hungry.
There's enough food in this country to feed everybody.
Please visit feedingamerica.org today and find your local food bank for ways to help.
Every dollar you donate helps provide 8 meals for kids like me, quietly struggling with hunger.
Together, we are Feeding America, brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.